I'm Sandy Fahler from the University of Wisconsin-Madison General Library Systems Archives Department. Today, March 7, 2006, I'm interviewing Professor Jean Barr, Chair of the UW-Madison Geology and Geophysics Department. This interview will be part of the Archives Department Oral History Project's Women in Science and Engineering series. Okay, we'll start with some questions about your background, Jean, if that's all right.
Okay.
How you got to Madison, if you could talk about where and when you were born.
That's fine.
Right? Describe your childhood and early schooling and talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
Okay, well, I was born in New York City, but my parents moved to California when I was less than a year old. So I consider myself a Californian not by birth, but at least by childhood. And I spent most of my childhood in California, but my father did a lot of international work as an electrical engineer, working on primarily defense department projects with radar. So we spent a year in Italy when I was 8 years old, and in England when I was nine, and a year and a half on a small island in the Marshall Islands called Kwajalein when I was in eighth grade and a freshman in high school. So. And in between that, we also had a number of summer trips related or unrelated to my father's work in Europe, to Japan, and a number of other places. So I guess one of the formative things in my childhood was just travel and experiencing other cultures. And I think that that's something that probably prepped me to be a geologist in the sense that geologists love to travel and love to see different parts of the world. So in terms of family members and teachers, I was always a very good student, and I liked math and science from the start. I think my father certainly encouraged particularly my interest in mathematics when we were living in Italy, and I was going to an Italian school where I didn't speak the language initially. I discovered that math, because it was symbolic, was something that I understood, and so I could do that very well in classes even before I picked up the Italian language, and so that probably gave me some positive reinforcement there. The school that I went to in England for a year in the equivalent of fourth grade had just a tremendous science program, particularly compared to, I think, what American schools were doing at that time. They had a special science teacher who came into the classes, and we did physics experiments. We were also fairly close to London, and we went into an astronomical observatory, planetarium, and a number of the British Museum, and which has a number of sort of science and technology things. And so I think that that reinforced my interest in science as well. When we lived out on Kwajalein when I was in eighth and ninth grade, this was in, I didn't say when I was born, I was born in 1954. And so I was 13 in 1967, which was the a time of a major revolution in the earth sciences, when the model of plate tectonics was suddenly being widely accepted in the geological community. The idea of continental drift had been around for a long time, but it wasn't until a lot of data started coming in from oceanographic surveys that showed the magnetic stripes that really illustrated the seafloor spreading, that this became widely accepted. And I was very fortunate in eighth grade out on Kwajalein to have an earth science teacher who was quite savvy and was already aware of plate tectonics. And we were living on an island that was part of a chain of seamounts, which is another one of the pieces of the puzzle of plate tectonics, these chains of islands that have moved across the ocean floor as the ocean floor has spread, and its overridden hotspots was another part of the plate tectonics evidence. And I remember very clearly her telling us that we were living on this fringing atoll of a seamount that was over a hotspot. So I think that piqued my interest as well in the earth sciences. And returned to California in 1968, and this was just about the time that there was a growing environmental consciousness. The first Earth Day was held in 1970, and I had gotten involved shortly after we got back to the States in the high school's ecology club, and we worked at a recycling center before recycling and curbside recycling was a common thing. We were actually working in a neighborhood in a neighboring town in Palo Alto, and our town didn't have any kind of a recycling center, so a group of us decided after volunteering for about a year in Palo Alto that we needed our own, and we set one up on a curbside. Basically, one fellow's father had a fruit stand, and he said, well, when it's not fruit season, you can use this as a recycling center. So we went around to grocery stores and collected big boxes and made a big sign that said recycling center, and then just waited for people to start coming, and they did. And that was a major activity of mine in high school, was running this recycling center, which was eventually taken over by the city and then eventually became a curbside thing. But I think that the I spent a lot of time in high school thinking about ways to try to change people's attitudes towards the environment, and was a very committed environmentalist, but also realized that changing people is really hard, and that my talents were in the sciences. And so when I applied to colleges, my main motivation was to try to find a place where I could study environmental science, because I thought that was the way that I could make a contribution to the environment rather than as a political organizer, mm-hmm. but as a scientist. Although I'd grown up in California, my parents were from the East Coast, and they had encouraged me to look more broadly than just California at schools. And as a 17-year-old, that struck me as go east, young woman. So I ended up applying primarily to schools on the East Coast. I chose Yale in the long run, in part because a savvy recruiter had convinced me that because they had a school of forestry and environmental sciences, that they were a good place to study the environment. I didn't realize until I got there that the School of Forestry and Environmental Sciences was actually a graduate program exclusively. Oh. but there was still a program at the undergraduate level called Combined Sciences, which seemed ideal for my interests, because you could take courses from a variety of the sciences and combine them in a creative way to look at environmental problems. So as a freshman, that's what I declared as my major and started taking the courses in the variety of sciences. By my sophomore year, they had decided that this interdisciplinary program was sort of unmanageable, and they were phasing it out, and told me that I should choose a regular science, and that I could still combine my environmental interests in creative ways through my elective courses. And so by that point, I had taken courses in physics and chemistry and biology, as well as in geology. The geology department was small and welcoming. They had field trips as part of their classes on the weekends, and so one could go camping, which was something that I enjoyed very much and had done with my parents as a child a lot. And so geology seemed like the right fit. So that's sort of how I got into geology, through both some things about the earth sciences that had piqued my interest as a child, but also through this motivation to study some sort of environmental science. Mm-hmm. So the geology program at Yale was a pretty traditional one. I did have an opportunity to take courses in water chemistry, and there were several environmental engineering courses that I took as electives, as well as some environmental policy courses. But when I graduated, I still wasn't very sure of what I could do with a degree in geology in an environmental context. I'd had a couple of summer internship experiences that some of them had been pointed to me by faculty at Yale. One of them was a job that I had found on my own in California one summer by simply going around to environmental and geotechnical firms and sort of knocking on their door. So I had spent one summer working for a company in Palo Alto that did a variety of sort of applied geology projects, from hill slope landslides and earthquake studies, and also did some environmental planning, and also did some work in groundwater. And when I graduated from college, they had a major project doing a earthquake safety study on the San Francisco Peninsula, looking at a bunch of dams that impounded water supply reservoirs and aquifer recharge reservoirs, and they needed a field person for that. So they offered me a job, which seemed like a good thing at the time, mm-hmm. And so I took that. Ended up working for them for 4 years, but the major project that I actually got involved in shortly after I joined the company was first a proposal and then a project to do a groundwater resources inventory in Mali, which is a country in West Africa.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote the proposal?
I worked on the proposal with my boss, who was a hydrogeologist. I think that my writing skills, even though I didn't know a lot of the technical things about geology, my writing skills were appreciated in this engineering company where mm-hmm. people hadn't had a lot of experience writing. And so they made use of me a lot in proposal writing. And initially the plan was that I would go over to West Africa just for 3 months. Part of the project was actually setting up a library, a data bank and a library on groundwater studies that had already been done. And so my boss's idea was that I could go over and work in this sort of office environment. Mali is nominally a Muslim country, and the firm was, I think, concerned about sending a woman over there. Also, I was the first woman geologist that the firm had ever hired, and so they were never quite sure what to do with me in any case. But the project got delayed for a variety of reasons, kept getting pushed off, and they were going to send another junior geologist, a man, over to do the field part of the project, which was training local technicians to make water level measurements and collect water samples and do some mapping. And as the project got pushed off, this other junior geologist got increasingly involved and then married to a woman with a small child and decided that he didn't want to take a young family over to West Africa. So the company was sort of left with me, who had been studying French to get primed for this, and my boss came in one day and he said, "How would you like to stay for 2 years rather than for 3 months?" And this, at the time, seemed like a very good opportunity, and so I readily agreed, and that, I think, changed my life in one sense. While I was over in Mali...
Now, did you go by yourself then?
Well, there was a senior person that the company hired who was actually the project manager, so I was sort of the junior flunky on the project, but I was actually... involved in most of the field work, and my boss had some health problems, and so he actually left after a year and a half, and I spent the last 6 months sort of running the project and finishing things up while he was back in the States and doing some things there. So in the end, I was the only person from the company that was on the project, but we had a team of local technicians and collaborators, so I wasn't doing this all alone. But it was while I was over there that I decided that hydrogeology, the study of groundwater, was something that I really felt was a important application of my geologic knowledge. It was important environmentally, and it was important to people providing clean water supply. But I had essentially no formal training in that subject as an undergraduate, because at that time hydrogeology was a specialty in the earth sciences that really wasn't taught very broadly in traditional geology departments. That's changed a lot in the last mm-hmm. 20 years, but I think Yale actually still doesn't have a hydrogeologist on their faculty. In any case, I decided that this was something that I could devote my career to, but if I was going to do that, I needed some formal education. So I had.
Can I just interrupt?
Sure.
I just talked a little bit about your experience in Mali.
Okay.
Were you afraid at all, or you had traveled so much?
I had traveled a lot, but traveling in the third world, of course, is a very different experience, and I had never been in a country that was that poor. Mali still is one of the poorest countries in the world. I wouldn't say that I was afraid. It was definitely a culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
But my supervisor, my boss in the field, had spent a lot of time in Africa. In fact, that's why he was hired for the job. And so I sort of followed his lead. And what I found was that the Malian people were incredibly warm and welcoming. And so I remember one of the things that we did as part of our field work is we would spend about a month in different, somewhat remote parts of the country, going around from village to village, collecting water samples and making measurements and doing a little bit of interviewing of the people, usually through a translator, finding out about whether their wells went dry and whether the water quality varied seasonally, did it get salty as the well went dry, and things like that. And we were traveling around on basically tracks. They're not roads, they're not paved, they're not even necessarily marked. And we would set up a base camp sort of centrally in the area or in some place where there was a little bit of electricity or options for getting clean water and food and things. One time we were out and it was getting late and we had gone farther than we had planned, and it was clear that we weren't going to be able to get back to our base camp that night, and so we stopped in a village and asked if we could just pitch a little. We had a cot and some mosquito netting and things like that, and the people said sure, and then shortly thereafter they showed up with boiled milk and goat meat, and these people had very, very little, and yet they were willing to share this with a bunch of strangers who were clearly much better off than them just because they were spending their night in the village.
Yeah.
So,
were there scientists there that you could work with?
Yes, I was working I was based in the capital, and there was a division of water and power. That we were this water and power service that we were working with, and this was a time when there was a lot of international aid poured into West Africa because of as a response to droughts in the early 70s. There were a whole series of droughts, and they had just gone through sort of the first one. So at the Servizi Hidrolik where I worked, there was a UN project that employed three or four French hydrogeologists. There was also a Canadian project that was setting up a water quality lab and water treatment system. And so there were about four people from that project. There was a French military alternative service hydrogeologist who worked on our project. Several of the technical staff of the Malian technical staff had been trained in former Soviet Union and in Romania, so they had advanced degrees from outside of Mali. The head of the program, head of the groundwater division there, who was a Malian, was actually married to a Hungarian woman who was a hydrogeologist, and actually it was because of her presence that I think my boss had finally decided that they could send me over for the amount of time that that they did, because they realized that there was an opportunity for women. It turns out if you're an expatriate, it sort of doesn't really matter if you're a man or a woman, you're sort of treated as this odd entity. And then there were, I was sort of Peace Corps age and mentality, and so there were a number of Peace Corps volunteers in the capital and actually around the country, and so that was sort of a network of Americans that that I could, you know, mm-hmm. Meet to socialize with occasionally when I, you know, had need to, mm-hmm. to speak English.
Okay, very interesting.
Yeah.
So then you went on to grad school.
So I went on to graduate school, and I ended up going to graduate school basically in my backyard, in part because I had one trip home from Mali about 6 months before the end of the project, and I used that in part to do a little bit of investigation of where I should apply to graduate school, and I visited one of my former professors at Yale to ask his advice, and he said, well, you know, there's an excellent program at Stanford, and he gave me names of several others. So because the firm that I was working for was based in Palo Alto, which is the city adjacent to Stanford, mm-hmm. I actually went over to Stanford while I was back. It was probably a Monday or a Tuesday in the middle of the week, in the middle of the summer, but it turned out that the hydrogeology professor was in his office when I went to pick up application materials, and they said, well, you ought to meet and talk with him. He knew my professor from Yale and also knew one of my former bosses from the consulting firm who had since left the consulting firm. So I said a couple of right names and suddenly found myself being taken to lunch and around right. campus, which I, you know, thought was really special treatment, although after being a graduate student there, I realized that this was the standard Erwin Remsen treatment of people that he thought were good prospects. Uh-huh. But it made a very positive impression, and in part just because of logistical difficulties, I ended up only applying to Stanford, and I sort of figured that, well, if I got in, that would be great, and if I didn't, I would work for another couple of years and apply mm-hmm. After I had investigated some other options. But I got admitted and got a good offer. And I started graduate school. So my plan was to...
What's a good offer?
Well, it was at the time, people would laugh at it now, but I think it was, you know, a stipend that was enough money to pay my rent and tuition. A tuition waiver.
Well, at Stanford, that was a pretty good
deal. And mm-hmm. I had saved some money from working for 4 years, and so I knew I wouldn't have to be, you know, living on food stamps. And also, I had learned to live fairly simply in Africa.
Sure.
What was I going to say? Oh, so my plan was to learn enough hydrogeology so that I could go back and do international development work. Mm-hmm. But I entered Stanford in 1980, which was sort of another seminal environmental event. Love Canal had been in the press starting in 1976, 77, but 78, it really got a lot of attention, and mm-hmm. 1980 was the year that the first Superfund legislation was passed. And so I landed in graduate school just at the time that the sort of emerging field of contaminant hydrogeology was starting to come into its own. And as a result of that, I sort of got diverted into problems of first world contamination and never have really gotten back to the third world water resources development work that originally motivated me, although I hope at some point on a sabbatical or maybe when I retire that I'll get back to some of that work. But mm-hmm. my graduate research led me to a field-based project in Canada, of all places, mostly through some connections at Stanford. There was a postdoctoral scholar who was at Stanford my first year who worked for the Canadian government, and I was looking for a project where I could do some field work, and he had an interesting project in eastern Canada at a former hazardous waste site that the Canadian government was sort of responsible for, and say they were using it as a research site, and he invited me up to work there, and I spent 2 summers up there doing my master's project, and initially thought I'd try to build a PhD around that. That turned out not to be such a fruitful avenue, in part, I think, because the faculty at Stanford wanted a little bit more involvement in it, and also because I didn't have a well-formulated hypothesis related to that site. So I ended up sort of switching gears and doing a much more theoretical dissertation project in conjunction with someone at the U.S. Geological Survey. But the motivation for it, looking at how slow chemical reactions affect transport, actually came from that site in Canada, because it was based on something we had observed in the field. But rather than doing more field testing for my dissertation work, I ended up doing some theoretical analysis and computer modeling. So in the end, it was a pretty nice package.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you guess.
There other women in your
yes,
field at that time?
Well, the interesting thing about Stanford was that Erwin Remsen, who was the major professor in hydrogeology there at the time, actually had quite a tradition of training women. He was the major advisor for Mary Anderson, who was my colleague here in this department, and had also trained a woman named Shirley Dreiss, who was a professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz. And Santa Cruz was just over the Santa Cruz Mountains from Stanford, and we had strong ties there. And my first year as a graduate student, they had all of us in a very large office that we called the bullpen. And I think there were about 8 of us, of which 4 were women. So there was a pretty good gender balance in the graduate program. There had also been a pretty good gender balance in my undergraduate program at Yale, which was sort of surprising, because when I was admitted to Yale, I was in the 4th class of women, and only 25% of the class as a whole was mm-hmm. women. But in my geology major cohort, I think about 30 or 40% of the majors were women. But there were essentially no women faculty. There were a couple of women faculty members in geosciences at Stanford, but I didn't take any courses from them because I was in a program that was pretty far from their mm-hmm. expertise. And I think the only instructor I had at the graduate level who was a woman was a civil engineer who taught applied statistics. So there weren't a lot of women role models, but there were a lot of women in my peer group, and I certainly never got the message in my academic training that there weren't things that I couldn't do because I was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit of that in the consulting firm that I worked for, mostly because they just had never hired a woman geologist, mm-hmm. and I recall that in my first year there, they had a first year review, and my boss came in and he said that he'd tried to get me a larger raise, but they felt that they couldn't pay me more than the other woman professional who was a computer scientist, and I felt like they should have been comparing me to the other junior right. geologists and not to the other woman in the firm.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, I think I came along mm-hmm. at a time when opportunities were opening
Sounds
up.
Sounds like it. Yeah. Then when you got your PhD, did you go right into academia, or did you?
Yes. So the chronology was this. In about a year before I was finishing my PhD, the fall of 1985, I was starting to think about what I was going to do next, and what I really thought I would like to do would be to work at the U.S. Geological Survey in a research position, at least for a while. And I was working for the USGS. They were supporting my dissertation research, and my research advisor was actually a scientist from the USGS. And so when I told him that I was interested in staying, he actually pulled a lot of strings and created a new position in his research group so that there would be a position for me. At the same time, looking through the ads in the American Geophysical Union's weekly newsletter, there was a academic position at New Mexico Tech that seemed to have my name written on it. That what they were looking for was someone who was doing exactly what I was doing in my dissertation research, which was sort of a combined physical chemical approach to hydrogeology. And so I thought, well, you know, I really should at least look into this to make sure that I'm making the right decision by staying at the USGS. But I was still, you know, at least a year from being done with my dissertation. The American Geophysical Union has an annual meeting in San Francisco in December, and so one of the faculty from New Mexico Tech was going to be at that meeting, and so I set up an appointment with him to talk a little bit about this position. And what he said was, well, we're really interested in filling this position a little bit sooner than you're going to be done, but we think we're going to have another position opening in the next year, and we'd really like to talk with you about that then. Mm-hmm. At the same meeting, Mary Anderson from this department was there and somehow got word that I was finishing, or I was getting sort of towards the finishing point of a dissertation and was perhaps on the job market. And Wisconsin had had an ad that was very broadly written and that didn't really seem to have my name written on it. They were looking for a quantitative geomorphologist, which is someone who studies sort of landscape processes, or a field hydrogeologist, which was maybe me, but it was written pretty broadly. And I also knew that Wisconsin had I was describing how it is that I made the Wisconsin connection at this American Geophysical Union meeting. I hadn't initially paid much attention to their ad because it didn't seem to fit me very closely. I also knew that they had tried to hire someone else that I knew from Stanford a year or so earlier, who was a geomorphologist, a landscape person who worked on landslides. And so my assumption was that although they were advertising this pretty broadly, what they really wanted was a geomorphologist. But Mary came up to me at the meeting and she said, I understand that you're on the job market, we have a position open, and if you're at all interested, please get in touch. So I did a little bit of soul searching, and I figured, well, if I was going to talk to New Mexico Tech, I probably should explore some other options as well. And I wrote a letter to Wisconsin with my CV, and most of, as I recall, a lot of my letters said, I'm not a geomorphologist, and if that's what you want, you don't want me. So I figured that I would send that out into the postal ether, and that would be the last that I heard of it. So I was shocked when probably a month or so later, on a Saturday afternoon, or maybe it was in the evening, I can't remember, I got a call from the University of Wisconsin, from Mary Anderson and Dave Michelson, who was the glacial geologist. And they were following up on my letter and asking me some questions. And at the end of this phone interview, they said, we'd like to invite you out for an interview. So I figured, well, I set myself on this path, I might as well go through with this interview process. This was in February, I guess.
I was going to ask, what time of the year was that?
This was in February of 1986. They wanted me to come about a month later in March, because I remember I came here on St. Patrick's Day. And then I thought, well, you know, I talked to New Mexico Tech. I told them that I was maybe interested in a job there, but we had agreed that we would hold this off. I felt like I should let them know that I was going to interview at Wisconsin. So I called them and told them that, and they said, well, we've just about finished our interview process, but we want to interview you too. So I ended up with setting up these two interviews sort of back to back. I came to Wisconsin first and then to New Mexico Tech. And when I came to Wisconsin, I was just very pleasantly surprised. I had actually visited Madison once before. I had taken a short course in hydrogeology here while I was working in consulting. My boss had sent me here for a hydrogeology short course. Mary had been one of the instructors. So I knew it was a nice town from that experience, but I didn't know much about the faculty and the students. But after interviewing here, I came away with the impression that you know, this would be a stimulating place to live, that it would be fun to work with graduate students, and that I did the sort of 180 degree turn, that maybe the best thing for me after finishing a PhD was actually to move on to another place where I would really, you know, be starting my research career independently and sort of not in the shadow of the people who had trained me at a PhD level. I was also very impressed with the program at New Mexico Tech. They've always had four or five hydrologists, hydrogeologists in a concentration, and so in terms of critical mass of faculty, it's a outstanding program, but it's in a very small town in New Mexico. And while I love the western landscape, and actually when I think of where I might retire, that's a part of the world that's high on my list, I didn't see it as a place where I would be happy as a single woman in my 30s moving for the long term. So Wisconsin made me an offer, and I accepted, sort of sheepishly told my advisor at the USGS that, you know, I had decided that I wanted to take an academic job, and he was very supportive. He was he was very happy for me, and but he had to then find someone else to fill this position that he had created, and he ended up finding someone good for that. I had also told Wisconsin when I agreed to interview that I wouldn't be able to start in the fall. So, but that was actually good to have this sort of deadline that I had to be here in January 87, because it gave me a little bit of leverage with my dissertation committee, who would have probably, I'm a perfectionist, and there were some perfectionists there, and the dissertation could have dragged on a lot longer if it hadn't.
I see. So, all right. You came to the University of Wisconsin then in 1987. One of the questions here is you described the UW hiring process you experienced. Well, that was pretty simple, really. Right?
It was pretty simple. It was a phone call and an interview. There were some things that, you know, in retrospect, I didn't know how to negotiate very well. You know, again, I was, you know, sort of doing this a bit on the fly, and I didn't have... I was still a bit far from finishing, and I was pretty naive about things. And so I didn't get a very good startup package. And they were hiring three people at one time, and one of those people had a lot better mentoring system in place and negotiated for a large lab and a large startup package. I was operating sort of in good faith, and when I asked for a certain amount of money and was told that they could only give me half that, and, you know, sort of good faith, I figured, well, I guess that's all they could afford, and I accepted it, and I shouldn't have given in so easily, and that actually ended up, slowing down my progress towards tenure. The subsequent chair, who came in a year after I was here, helped remedy that somewhat by pushing through a lab modernization grant that got me a fair amount of equipment. But it was, I should have gotten, if I had been a more savvy negotiator, and if the university had been more straightforward, I think I could have gotten a much quicker start on my research in terms of equipment and things like that.
Now, do you tell the grad students that work with you that story?
I don't tell them that in so many words, yeah. But I do try to advise them to, you know, think carefully about what they need and to mm-hmm. not, you know, not give in too easily mm-hmm. when people say, because there is a sort of a negotiating process. And I think women aren't, at least of my generation, we're not trained to negotiate.
Mm-hmm. Probably true. Okay, your career at Madison, Jean. You've talked a little bit about this, but maybe you could say just a little more. What had you heard about the reputation of the department here in Madison? What is its national reputation, and what is it best known for?
Well, you know, at the time that I was looking at graduate schools, I knew it was a good program in hydrogeology. There was Mary Anderson had established a strong reputation for the program. I'd taken a short course here, so it was known nationally, not only in academic circles, but in consulting circles. And that, it turns out that reputation was really established initially by Dave Stevenson, who was Mary's predecessor. He left a tenured position here to go into consulting, but eventually became the president of the Geological Society of America, and now is the president of the Geological Society of America Foundation. So, but I must admit, I didn't know a lot about the reputation of the department as a whole at the time that I was applying. I just knew that it had a good program in my field. Another part of the hiring process, actually, that they did very effectively was that they introduced me not only to people within this department, but to people across campus, particularly in civil engineering and the State Geologic and Natural History Survey, who had water interests. And one of the things that appealed to me very strongly was that it by coming here, I would have access not only to colleagues in this department, but colleagues across the university who shared interests in water and interdisciplinary mm-hmm. studies. So. And the Water Resources Management Program, which is a professional master's program, I had heard a little bit about. And there's an Institute for Environmental Studies that, at the time I arrived, was about 25 years old. So again, I sort of in my environmental consciousness, there was an awareness of Madison. Since coming here, I've learned a lot more about the history of the department, and it's, I think, probably best known just for the fact that it's a broad-based department that has trained strong scientists at both the undergraduate and graduate levels in a wide variety of areas. It's had a long-standing relationship to the energy industries, petroleum companies, and for a school in the Midwest where we're pretty far from the oil resources, that's mm-hmm. You know, a bit surprising, but it's a reputation that continues to today. Mm-hmm. It has a strong reputation in geophysics, although, you know, a small group, but we have former professors after whom major geophysics awards are named. Mm-hmm. I think right now it's very well known for an increasing sophistication of analytical facilities in isotope geochemistry and geochronology, and that's something that's developed for the most part since I've been here. It had started at the time, I started probably in the decade in which I was hired, and, mm-hmm. and has continued to build its reputation mm-hmm. Till today. Some of the interesting facts about the department is I think that there are more graduates of the University of Wisconsin that have gone on for PhDs and academic careers than any other state school. If you look at the faculty around the country, the Wisconsin connections are broad and deep.
Mm-hmm. Nice to hear.
Yeah.
All right, describe the facilities in which you work.
Okay, so you can. We are currently sitting in my rather messy office.
Now, is this your office, or is this the office of the department chair?
This is my research office,
I
have
okay.
as a department chair, I have a second office on the second floor, which I've been trying very hard to keep somewhat less cluttered and keep it populated mostly with things that have to do with department chair business. In addition to that, when I came here, I was given shared access to a lab that's across the hall, the hydrogeology lab, which was Mary Anderson's lab, and also to a small amount of storage space in the basement, in a basement garage. We called it the cage because it's surrounded by chicken wires so that we can put field equipment in there somewhat safely. Since I've been here, and actually primarily only in the last 6 or 7 years, we've actually expanded our hydrogeology domain a bit. The whole garage staging area that surrounds the cage was designated for the hydrogeology and quaternary research group's use probably 7 or 8 years ago. Before that, there was a lot of just sort of general department equipment that got stored in there, but we finally now, with sort of full access to that, have a working area in the basement where we can store core samples and lay them out to look at them, where we can do preparations for field work with a certain amount of space. Mm-hmm. We also, 5 or 6 years ago, got, we used to have a small computer lab sort of in the interior of the main hydrogeology lab, which was not very well ventilated and not very large, and we got another room. It's probably about the size of this combined office, but a little bit different shape, that's on the third floor, that's now our computer lab, which has about 6 computers and then a couple of places where students can bring laptops and plug them in for computer modeling, because one of the big things that we do in hydrogeology, we do field work, but we also test our conceptual models of what's going on in the field with computer models. So computer modeling is a sort of integral part of our research. Mm-hmm. So all of those facilities are essentially shared with Mary Anderson. Our fourth floor lab here has served a dual purpose ever since I've been here, as being both a research lab where we do a little bit of laboratory bench scale sort of work, where we store a lot of field measurement equipment that we take out into the field, but also a place where we set up demonstrations for classes. So we have a sand tank model. It looks sort of like a big ant farm in which we can run water through with dye, and that's used both in our hydrogeology classes as well as in most of the introductory geology classes. And then for the hydrogeology class that I teach in the fall, we do some experiments where we take columns and we run water through them, and we need a place to set that up. The use of the lab as sort of a teaching demonstration area has up till now precluded us from making full use of that lab for research purposes, because we can't have experiments set up at the same time that we have these demonstrations going up. But we're in the process right now of remodeling another room on the fourth floor as a wet teaching lab. And as soon as that remodeling is done, we'll be able to move all of the teaching demonstration equipment out of the hydrogeology lab and into that teaching lab, and that will give us more full access to the lab there. And then my students have also used labs, other labs in this building, as well as other labs around the university. We've used analytical equipment in soil science and in engineering and in the water environmental chemistry and technology program as well, because we don't have an analytical facility in our lab to do measurements of concentrations in water, so we use labs in other places. But this is a good institution for sort of sharing of lab facilities. That's it's one of the strengths of this this place, that you aren't restricted to only right. using exactly what you have under right. your control.
Yeah, which I would assume is not always the case, I would guess, on some campuses.
Yeah. And that was one of the things, again, that impressed me when I came here, that there were lots of opportunities to work with people around campus, and that certainly proved true.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads us right into the next question. Describe the culture of your department. Is a collaborative work encouraged? And also, obviously, collaborative work is encouraged across the campus
as well. I think that's generally true. I mean, there's certainly, I think the overall culture, or what I would like the culture to be, is a respect for the variety of ways that we do research and the variety of research that we do. And some types of research lend themselves naturally to collaboration. When you're dealing with water, people who deal with underground water certainly need to work with people who are dealing with surface water. There are other types of geoscience where people work quite well, you know, sort of independently or with collaborators that are in other countries or in other places. And so there's a lot of different models. I compared to some other institutions that I know of, I think our department and this institution in general has been open to a variety of those kinds of those modes.
Mm-hmm.
There are always groups who think, well, what I do is the most important thing, and we have a little bit of that in our department as
sure.
well, unfortunately. But I think in general, we've tried to maintain a breadth of coverage in the geosciences, and I think that's been one of our strengths. And I think in doing that, one of the things that happens naturally is that you develop a respect for the variety of types of research that go on.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe your tenure process?
Sure. It's a little bit of a blur now. It was a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was a stressful process. I think it sort of always is. And I think that I would have thrived more if I had spent a couple of years doing a postdoc and had a better idea of, you know, how to write grant proposals and how to get things up and running. I arrived here, I took on a number of students, you know, right away, and then I felt like I was sort of, you know, scrambling to get them busy and funded and generate research results. In the end, I think the process went quite well, I think the department was always quite supportive. I think they want junior faculty to succeed, but along the way, you're always getting the message that you're not doing enough. You're not getting enough papers out, you're not bringing in enough grant money, you're spending too much time on your teaching, you're juggling a whole lot of things. And so, when the process was over, everyone, you know, made a point of coming to me and telling me that, you know, the votes were unanimous, and people on the divisional committee, you know, said the same thing. And I think that the department really did a good job of putting no matter what the sort of paper record is, what the department puts in its evaluation that they send to the divisional committee is very mm-hmm. important, and I'm sure that the department must have put a very strong positive spin on what they saw of my record.
Mm-hmm.
But you always sort of end up feeling like, well, you know, are they going to change their mind? Was I inadequate? And I think it wasn't until 5 years later, when I wasn't even anticipating it, the department told me that they had voted to promote me to full professor, that I sort of felt like, oh, they really do like me. I could sort of relax.
Yep. I can't imagine that pressure. I mean, how do you stay healthy?
I didn't really. I actually developed some back problems that were, I think, partly physical. I overused some muscles in a cross-country ski race, and things didn't get diagnosed in a timely way, and it developed into a sort of a chronic condition that affected my sleep patterns and all sorts of other things. But I'm sure that the stress of the tenure track contributed to that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would guess that there's, in a position like yours today, there's still stress. I mean, there's all of these things that are going on around you.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of stress.
It's a different kind of stress, and I think I've gotten better at handling it. And, you know, for everything that's bad about the tenure process, the security that you get from having tenure is a big part in helping you handle the stress afterwards, because you know, you're not going to lose your job.
Yeah.
I think that's the most stressful part of the tenure process, is it towards the end you sort of have realized that you really do like this academic job, and if you don't get tenure, then, you know, what is it that you're going to do next?
I can understand that part. What courses have you taught? And just talk about your teaching.
Okay, so when I arrived, they asked me, what would you like to teach? I had an idea for a course that I had not taken because it wasn't offered, but that I thought was something important to develop, and I called it contaminant hydrogeology. It turns out that now there are textbooks in contaminant hydrogeology, and there are courses all over the country that are called contaminant hydrogeology, but I was certainly one of the first to begin offering this. So when I arrived in January of 87, they said, that sounds great, why don't you put this course together? So my first semester of teaching, I was putting together essentially from scratch and without a textbook, and the textbooks that exist still aren't very good, a brand new course that I had never taken, but that I had a vision of what should be in it. But it was a tremendous amount of work to put it together, and I got over 30 students, you know, right away, because there was sort of a pent-up demand for this course. And so I've been teaching that course every year except the years that I've been on leave, on sabbatical. And the enrollments have fluctuated. There was a big boom in employment in environmental consulting in the mid-90s. And at one point I had over 50 students in this sort of upper level graduate course, which is a large enrollment for a course at that level. This semester I have about 15, and that's a nice sort of manageable number. And then the other sort of core course that I've taught very regularly is the fall semester hydrogeology course, which is again a upper level graduate course. Mary Anderson had been teaching that before I arrived, but she was slated to go on sabbatical the year after I arrived, so I knew that I would have to teach it in my second year here. And what she said is, well, why don't you teach it in your first year, and then you'll be able to repeat it for a couple of years. And as it's worked out, Mary and I have sometimes shared that course. I've also shared it with Herb Wang, who's the associate dean. Mm-hmm. But until this year, when I became department chair, I basically taught that course every fall. So I've taught the fall the hydrogeology course, and in the spring the contaminant hydrogeology course. And the hydrogeology course went up in that mid-90s peak, went up to about 110 students in it. Now it's down in the sort of 30 range. When Mary had been teaching it, it didn't have a lab, but it had an option for a lab or a discussion section, and I felt very strongly that it needed a lab, that you need some hands-on experience. And I guess that's part of my teaching philosophy, is you need a lot more than just someone standing up and lecturing. You need sort of hands-on exercises or labs. So I put a lot of energy into developing a lab component for that course, and even with the teaching assistant who runs the lab, some of the lab exercises are ones where you really need a couple of bodies there, including a field exercise that I've when I've taught it, I've always been a participant in some of the lab work as well.
Is it a different field experience every course, or do you?
No, we have. There's a field site that was developed by a PhD student. He put in a whole bunch of wells in a very small area to try to look at the variability, the local scale variability in hydrogeologic properties, and managed to persuade the landowners to let him leave the wells in so that we could use it for this field exercise. So we have a very convenient place. It's over near Lake Waubesa, not too far from you live, probably. Mm-hmm. The Waubesa Beach Community Center. That's a little plot of land that I call the Pisometer Forest. Pisometers are named for a well, so it looks like a little forest of PVC pipes sticking out of the ground, but it provides a convenient place to do that. So teach those two courses regularly. I also, since the job that I was hired for was field hydrogeologist, also got drafted to teach a summer course, a three-week course on field methods in hydrogeology. And that course, before I arrived, had been taught by Ken Bradbury from the State Geologic and Natural History Survey. And the first year that I came, he and I taught it together. And then I've been teaching that on my own since then. In that mid-90s period, I was teaching it every summer. The demand now is such that I can offer it every other summer and take care of all the people that need to take that. And I offer that primarily for my own graduate students in a sense, because they need some field skills to do their research, but there are students from a variety of programs on campus, civil engineering, water resources management, soil science, who take the course as well. And we, a lot of the exercises in it, rather than going back to the same place every year, we have some places that we go back to, but we also use it a bit to bootstrap some of our own research projects. So if we have an experiment or some drilling or something that we need to do for our research, we do it in conjunction with the class so that we have more people to participate. And I think the students appreciate working on something that actually has some utility rather than a sort of an isolated exercise. Mm-hmm. In addition to those courses in my specialty, I've also taught introductory level course in environmental geology. I've taught that as part of a team, usually with a geophysicist. So the geophysicist does the sort of sexy volcanoes and earthquakes part of it, and then I do the still sexy but not quite surface processes, groundwater, surface water, coastal processes. And then we tend to share the lectures on energy resources. One of my recent passions as a longstanding environmentalist, I put a solar roof on my house.
I read about it
6 years ago, and so I enjoy talking about alternative energy in that course. And another couple of things, I've been involved in a couple of studies for the National Research Council, one related to radioactive waste, and so that always makes a good topic for the environmental geology course, and another looking at restoration of the Everglades ecosystem, and it's a very interesting case study in how do you balance water demands and
we're ready.
Okay. So I was talking about teaching, and I guess the point I was trying to make is that I, to the extent that I can, I like to weave into my lectures things that I've had some personal involvement in. It's more interesting to me, and I think it's interesting to the students to get that perspective.
I would think so. How is your research funded? Let's talk about your research.
Okay, so I've done a lot of different kinds of things. I think I'm, well, I'm motivated by the general topic of water resources for people and the environment. I've looked at problems at a whole variety of scales, and there's lots of different funding agencies that are interested in different components of that project. My current research, I have sort of two major groups of projects that are going on right now. One is related to former underground storage tank sites where gasoline leaked into the ground, and I have a project that's funded in part by the Environmental Protection Agency and in part by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, which is aimed at looking at how the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Commerce, which regulate these sites in the state, have been approaching a strategy to clean these up by basically letting nature do its work. It's something that we call natural attenuation. And they've been doing this, they've been using that as a remediation strategy now for about 10 years. What we've been doing is looking at some sites that have been administratively closed for about 5 years, going back and seeing how effective is this strategy. Is the area of the contamination that we call the plume, is it getting smaller over time? Is it stable? Is it larger? What we found in general is that the contaminated groundwater area is not getting larger, but it's also not getting smaller very quickly. And that may have some implications for the future policy. So it's sort of some science that's driven by policy. Mm-hmm. Another project, which actually has some EPA funding in the form of a graduate student fellowship, and that has also been supported by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and some money that comes into the University of Wisconsin system as a whole from the state legislature for groundwater studies, is looking at the impacts of unsewered subdivisions on groundwater quality. There's been in Dane County, where we live, an effective ban on new subdivisions that rely on on-site wastewater treatment called septic systems rather than municipal sewers, as a way of taking care of their wastewater. The ban was motivated in part by concerns about groundwater quality, and I think also, although not stated explicitly, I think it's been a very effective land use planning strategy to try to control urban sprawl. But the questions of the impacts on groundwater quality, while there's a lot of work that suggests that there is an impact, there isn't a lot that really demonstrates how much of that, how much of the contamination is from septic systems versus agricultural land uses that preceded the developments. And there also have been some new technologies in septic systems that have been implemented, developed over the years. So the Builders Association in Dane County put a lot of pressure on the county executive to allow new unsewered subdivisions with this novel septic technology. And she said, okay, we'll allow one new unsewered subdivision, but there have to be studies to document how these systems are working and what the impacts are. So one of my PhD students, Jeff Wilcox, has been working on that project. He did a nice study of the groundwater quality before the subdivision was developed, which showed widespread contamination from agricultural activity. And now, as the subdivision is getting built, he's looking at ways of trying to tease out what are the septic influences versus the agricultural impacts. Mm-hmm. And the complication there is that animal waste generates very similar sorts of things in the groundwater as human waste. So what Jeff has actually decided to focus on are some things that animals wouldn't generate, namely things like pharmaceuticals and hormones, personal care products, things like caffeine and acetaminophen, and these are substances in groundwater that have only recently been looked for, and the analytical techniques to look for them are still being developed. Mm-hmm. And there's been more work looking at these kinds of substances in streams and lakes than there has been in groundwater. So a big part of that work has been to optimize some of the analytical techniques, and Jeff is now doing some experiments in our basement lab in running these substances through columns to see how quickly they move relative to how quickly groundwater moves. And then he's going to be doing some field experiments at sites at the subdivision where septic systems are now there to at least look at the rate at which water is moving. Jeff will probably graduate in about a year, but the provision of this new subdivision was that there would be monitoring for a 10-year period, so we expect that there'll be some other interesting follow-on studies from that.
Where is that subdivision?
It's just east of Sun Prairie.
Oh, okay.
So it's in the sort of Sun Prairie area. If it were going to be connected to a municipal sewer system, it would be the Sun Prairie system, but it's a little bit farther out. So my current funding is primarily from state sources and from the Environmental Protection Agency. I was involved in a fairly large EPA-funded project starting in, I guess, 2000 to 2004, called a Water and Watersheds Initiative, which was an interdisciplinary project including not only hydrogeologists, but also surface water hydrologists and ecologists and people from urban and regional planning and rural sociology. And we were looking at the overall goal was to identify what kinds of strategies can be used during suburban expansion that will protect groundwater and surface water resources and wetland ecosystems. So the focus of the hydrogeology portion of that was to develop a better understanding of the sources of water that supply springs in the Madison area. And then our understanding of the spring sources leads directly to what kinds of strategies you need to protect them. And the bottom line was that what we really need to be doing is making sure that we're, as we pave over the landscape, we find an alternate way for the water, for rainfall, to get back into the groundwater system rather than short-circuiting it. Mm-hmm. I've had in the past also funding from the National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy, consortium called the Gas Research Institute that was funded by the energy industries, where we were looking at deep groundwater flow at the sedimentary basin scale level, down at the levels where natural gas and petroleum hydrocarbons are important, and the linkages between groundwater flow and those kinds of energy resources. So that's sort of a different scale of problem. And over the years, I've had a generous amount of funding, I'd say, from some of these state sources of the Department of Natural Resources, as well as the UW system. So that's where the major sources of funding. I, in contrast to some of the research groups in this department, I don't have millions and millions of dollars of research funding. We're often doing things on a bit of a shoestring, but I think we're doing things that people really care about, and there's a local client who's intimately interested in our results, and that gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Now, you sent me that information on the Florida Everglades
project. Yes.
And I read that, and I said, this looks like an impossible situation. Are you involved in that?
Well, at this point, I've sort of blissfully retired from my major involvement. My involvement was as part of a outside review committee that was set up by the National Research Council, which is a branch of the National Academies of Science. Mm-hmm. When if you read in the newspaper about, you know, National Academies study says such and such, it's the usually a committee of the National Research Council that mm-hmm. does this. And I was invited to be a member of this committee because one of the major strategies that they're trying to use to conserve water in the Everglades for this restoration is to store it underground in aquifers. So they needed a hydrogeologist on the committee. I eventually ended up being the chair of the committee when the original chair had some health problems, and I had sort of directed a subcommittee that had come out with the first report, and I guess people thought I was effective in managing that, so I became the chair of the entire committee. And you're right, it's a really challenging problem. I think it's probably a misnomer to call it a restoration. What they're trying to do is to collect enough water so that they can improve the ecosystem health in some parts of the system, and that's the best that they're going to be able to do. The problem is that they're trying to meet human demands for water and flood control in urban areas, human demands for water for agriculture, preserve sport fishing opportunities, and at the same time provide more water in some critical areas of the ecosystem. And they've promised it all, and I think they're only going to be able to deliver part of it. And I think the concern among the environmental community is that the flood control and the agricultural water supply and the sports fishing is going to get the water they need before the ecosystem does. So,
now, is that a federally funded project?
It's a federally funded project and a state funded project. So the state of Florida and the federal government are the two major players. It's an $8 billion 30-year project, and about half of the money is supposed to come from the state of Florida and half from the federal government. So it, you know, it's something that has national importance in the sense that our tax dollars are paying for it. I think it has national importance because I think that the Everglades ecosystem, the part of it that we can improve somewhat as a unique ecosystem, it's important to global biodiversity as well as sort of local environmental issues.
Well, I wish everybody good luck. That's
yes. So I still get calls about it.
But I'll bet. But you don't plan on going back into the fray?
I'm probably not back into the fray. Our committee probably ruffled enough feathers. So there's a follow-on committee that is chaired by a committee member who was on the committee that I chaired. But when they established the follow-on committee, I felt that it was probably time for me to step down, and it was a great thing to be involved in, but I'm actually sort of relieved to be out of the fray.
Well, that helps. What you just said helps me move right into the next question. You've described and summarized your researcher. What do you consider to be your most important contribution to your field? You're young, so you still have time to make that, but so far.
I mean, I guess in one sense, probably the most important contribution I've made is the students that I've trained. You know, as an educator, I take a lot of pride in that. I've graduated some 30-odd students, of which 8 are PhDs. My most recent PhD, I just had one of my PhD students got tenure at Virginia Tech, which is a very good institution, this last summer, and I have several others who are in tenure track positions. So that's probably my biggest legacy. I guess the other contribution on sort of a broad scale, I was tapped in 2003 to be a distinguished lecturer for the Geological Society of America's Hydrogeology Division. And I gave lectures at 60 different institutions over
the
course
schedule.
Of a year. What I'd like to think is one of my important contributions. A lot of our work has demonstrated how much local scale variability there is in groundwater chemistry, even in places where the geology seems very uniform. And pointing that out telling people how you can use that kind of information to deduce processes, I think, is an important mm-hmm. contribution. It's not something that I've discovered, but I think the fact that I had a chance to really broadcast that message, I hope is alerting other people to look for things that they might have ignored.
What were some of the highlights of that year?
Oh, wow. I guess the personal highlights for me were I love to travel.
That's good.
And so I got to see a large part of the country. I got to go to Mardi Gras by scheduling a talk, close to at Baton at Louisiana State right mm-hmm. before Mardi Gras. I spent Easter in Virginia. I was in the fall colors in New England. Mm-hmm. I got a guided tour of the deposits at the base of Mount St. Helens from one of the people who, mm-hmm. has worked on that since mm-hmm. the mountain erupted. Lots of interesting local field trips with my hosts. Chances to hike in, mountains in Canada and Nevada and New England. Mm-hmm.
So you were able to tack on some personal time.
I decided that the only way to do this, to survive it, was to make sure that I had, as much personal time and fun sure. and a chance to see friends and relatives along the way. I fortunately had actually already arranged a sabbatical for that year at the time that I was going to do something else with my sabbatical. Mm-hmm. And when I got asked to do the lecture tour, I sort of thought about, well, what should a sabbatical be? And it's a, renewal, a chance to explore new areas. And I decided, what better way could I use the time than to go and talk to researchers at a whole variety of institutions and really get a handle on what was going on in my field. And so that was, professionally, that was the benefit of it. The talks, after you've given the same one or two talks two or three times, you can sort of give it in your sleep. And what was really productive and stimulating about the visits was a chance to talk with students and researchers and learn about what they're doing, and then come back with new ideas about things that I might be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounded like a great opportunity.
Yes,
but
yes. I would never do it again, but I'm glad that I had a chance to do it once. And my department was very supportive. I had the spring semester off for a sabbatical, but then Dean Wang very kindly agreed to co-teach the fall course with me so that I could arrange some additional trips in the fall around a somewhat reduced teaching schedule. And the department chair at the time supported that as well.
Because you couldn't have been able to come back to Madison that often, did you?
No, I didn't have a very big budget, so I did a lot of it by car. Which gave me a lot of flexibility because
sure.
I could stop and see things on the way. But I had sort of four major driving segments of the tour that mm-hmm. I did, and mm-hmm. I was I'd be home for one weekend and then off again.
Well,
so it's a good thing I don't have a family that needed me
right,
to be home.
Right, exactly. What are the most significant developments in your field of study? I know you've said a few things as you talked about.
Yeah. I guess there's been a lot of discussion in the hydrogeologic community about where are we as a science. And in some senses, hydrogeology is a relatively young field in the geosciences. As I mentioned there, at the time I was going to college, there were only a handful of universities that even had a hydrogeologist on the faculty. So there was a tremendous growth in the 70s and early 80s in our understanding of the processes that control the movement of contaminants through groundwater systems, and particularly the processes that change their concentrations through sort of spreading of contaminants. Mm-hmm. So that was a major development, and I think we're still learning more about that, but we've also, in some senses, that's matured. Starting in the early 80s, and I think continuing to the present, probably the newer developments is our recognition of the importance of microbial processes in transforming contaminants in groundwater systems. And I think we're still on a learning curve there in terms of what kind of diversity of microbial populations is there in the subsurface, how can we characterize that. The samples that we take are not necessarily going to represent what's going on in the aquifer system, and what are the rates of those processes. So it's sort of at the interface between microbiology and hydrogeology is one of the developments. What we continue to do in hydrogeology in a practical sense often continues to involve water resources for people, and in a lot of senses the science of that is pretty well developed, and what varies from place to place are the sort of the local characteristics. And so there's been a lot of discussion in the hydrogeologic community that, are we a mature and dying science? I think that the future developments are all going to be at the interfaces of hydrogeology and some other area. And for example, the connection between hydrogeology and ecosystems is something that we're still mm-hmm. working to develop. So I guess those are some of the directions that the field is going.
Right. I realized when I asked you about your research, I didn't ask you about publications.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to, if you could just talk about your publications. And I'm sorry.
Obviously, getting publications out is an important part of the academic.
What you do in your spare time.
And I haven't been as diligent in getting all of my students' work into press as I probably should, but we're going in that direction. I've published in a large variety of journals. Some people tend to sort of publish entirely in one journal, but I always try to look at what we're publishing and think about who is the audience for. We've got a paper right now that we're working on for wetlands, which not all hydrogeologists look at, but it's a paper on some of the hydrogeology and hydrogeochemistry of a fairly intact wetland community, and you need to understand the local variability in that system in order to be able to deduce, what is it that's changed when a system degrades, mm-hmm. for example. I've published in the major journals that I've published in have been Water Resources Research, the journal Groundwater, the journal Contaminant Hydrogeology. I have a paper in the Journal of Hydrology that's just coming out, which is a sort of a groundwater, surface water, riparian wetland area. So I have 40 or so refereed mm-hmm. publications over the years, and then lots of abstracts at meetings. Most of my publications, actually the first authors are students. Mm-hmm. I sort of feel like I'm often sort of managing, I have a good idea, but it's a little bit half-baked, and I give it to my students, and they take it, and they run with it, and mm-hmm. then we iterate back and forth during the process. And so mm-hmm. I feel like I have a lot of input, but it's also really their work, and I think it's appropriate that they get first authorship.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'll just move out of research and talk a little bit about the whole administrative process, and not necessarily as department chair, but about faculty governance, committee work, other campus activities.
This is an unusual place, and I realized this even more when I went on the lecture tour, how unusual it is, the culture of faculty governance here, that rather than having a lot of administrators, even though the state legislature thinks we're overstocked with administrators, in fact, most of the administration and most of the work is really done by the faculty. Now, we've got some excellent support staff in this department, but we've always done a lot of things by committee. So there's a finance committee, and they work with the people who manage the books, but to actually make the decisions about where we're going to spend our money and how much we have to spend, for example. I've been involved in, you know, just about every committee that we have in the department. The department always has involved junior faculty in committee work. They try to buffer them a little bit, but I've been involved in undergraduate studies and graduate admissions and finance and the computer committee and the sort of ill-fated space committee that we had before we added the space to the building, which alleviated a lot of our space conditions. You know, that takes up, you know, a certain amount of your time because there isn't anyone else that's doing that.
Sure.
So I've been involved in a lot of administrative duties on the department level. At the university level, I haven't really been involved in much sort of higher level university things. I think I was a senator for one term, but I haven't been actively involved in that. But I've been involved in a lot of other programs in the university and done similar sorts of committee duties in those programs as I've done in this department. The Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, which administers the Water Resources Management Program, is a program that I've been involved with since my first year here. I got recruited to be part of the Water Resources Management faculty, and I think I've been on the admissions committee for that program every year except for, you know, three or four, and I chaired that program in the late 90s, which provided a little bit of summer salary, but also, you know, came with it the responsibility for being one of the leaders of the student summer workshop and trying to find funding for that, and so that gave me a little bit of taste for some of the kinds of things I now do as department chair. I've also been involved in a program called Geological Engineering, which is a cross-college. It's administered by the College of Engineering, but involves faculty from geology as well, and operates as sort of a virtual department. It has a chair, and we have faculty meetings and things like that, but it has only a very small budget to manage. And again, I've been on undergraduate studies, curriculum committees for that, and advise a lot of students, particularly undergraduates, in that program. And then for 2 years, I was the one of the faculty co-advisors for a residential learning community on campus, which is a dorm that houses students with a particular focus, and the one that I was involved with is called Women in Science and Engineering, and there are about 150 undergraduate women who live in a selected portion of one of the dorms, and the job of the faculty co-director is to work with the student staff, and there's also a program coordinator and some housing staff to think about activities for the program, to develop enrichment opportunities, lab tours off campus, things like that for the students. And that was something that I agreed to do because most of these things are things I agree to do because I think they're worthwhile, and I have some personal connection, and obviously as a woman scientist, I felt a very personal connection to encouraging young women in science. Although I'm no longer the faculty co-director, I'm still involved in some of their activities. One of the things I started as faculty co-director was a fall and a spring camping trip. Actually, the students started it, and I said, well, I love to camp. I'm happy to do this. So the camping trips have always been sort of a combination of learning a little bit about the geology of where we're going and perhaps a little bit of ecology, and some other things. So I'll be doing that again. We're going to Blue Mounds in April, and taking a tour of the Cave of the Mounds, and we'll do some hiking and things like that. And also, one of the things that we talked about during my last semester as faculty co-director was putting together an evening seminar for the students, sort of dinner and a conversation. So a series of guest speakers and then some conversations after that. And that was put in place this past fall. And so in the fall, I participated as a sort of a discussion leader, went to the dinners with talks and came to the dinners afterwards to help lead the discussion. This spring I haven't been attending, but I'm going to actually be giving a talk later in the semester on the Everglades. I'll be one of the speakers that they can discuss.
That'll be an interesting one, I'm sure. So it's obviously worthwhile as far as you're concerned.
It's worthwhile both anecdotally, and we actually commissioned a study last year, which was the 10th year that the program had been in existence, to look at some of the data about time to graduation and GPAs and things of a cohort, a group that had gone.
Well, how did you become department chair?
Well, we have the faculty governance model, at least as it plays out in our department, and I think in most of the departments in letters and science, involves a rotating department chair. We don't hire people from outside to come in and be chair for life. So the culture that's evolved in our department is that almost everyone gets to be chair, or has to be chair. at some point in their career, unless you prove yourself completely incompetent. So I tried that tack, and then I cleverly the previous term I scheduled a sabbatical at the start of the new chair's term, which basically made me ineligible. But I knew that my number was coming up. So each time we have a change of chair, this sort of process of looking at who's available, which is basically the full professors who have not already done it, and then how this works into their schedule and whether people feel comfortable with someone being chair. I guess that's the ultimate thing. And the timing wasn't great for me this time around because Mary Anderson is on sabbatical this year, and she's the one that I can normally trade off classes with. But the timing wasn't good for anybody else either. So when Herb Wang agreed to teach the fall hydrogeology course in my place, and the department agreed to put up some additional money so that Randy Hunt, who's a affiliated faculty member from the U.S. Geological Survey, could teach the part of the course that dealt with hydrogeochemistry, which Herb really is not well versed in, that seemed like an acceptable option. Mm-hmm. So I agreed to be chair. I was the only one that was nominated, so it was a unanimous election by default. And then, having agreed to do that, I always try to say, well, if I'm going to do something, I should make this an interesting learning experience. So that's what I've been trying to do with the department chair job, and it has been an interesting learning experience. And it's also it is a chance to think a little bit more broadly about what are the priorities of the department. And one of the things that I'm hoping to do, I haven't made a lot of progress yet, but hoping to work on increasing the diversity of our student population through initiatives at several different levels, including trying to get more involvement with the high school people program, which is recruiting high school students from selected schools in Milwaukee and some of the Native American tribes to the Madison campus, but more importantly, in our case, to the geosciences by providing them with some opportunities to go camping and see some hands-on things. So that hasn't yet materialized, but I have some plans for doing that, and then trying to boost our recruiting at the graduate level as well. So it's it's an interesting challenge to focus on things that I don't in my normal course of doing research and sort of regular teaching.
So there are some positive things, or you're making it a positive.
I'm making it a positive thing. I guess the other positive thing is that the university has a number of workshops and gatherings for department chairs, and so I've enjoyed meeting chairs from other departments that I wouldn't normally cross paths with, and learning that, you know, our issues aren't very different from those in some other departments that may have, you know, different cultures. Yeah. But
okay. How's the climate for women here?
From my perspective in this department, I think it's quite good. I don't know what it was like when Mary Anderson was the only woman. When I was hired, they hired two of us. We've always had at least three, and now we have five out of 19 faculty who are women. We're still a minority, clearly, but within the physical sciences, I think we have the highest percentage of women faculty in any department at the university. So in my department, I think the climate has always been quite good. I think at the university as a whole, I know in engineering, you know, women faculty are greatly outnumbered. But that also has changed dramatically since I came here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there continue, I suppose, to be subtle things and things that, you know, I gave the example of not being well versed in how to negotiate, and I expect that if you look, you know, across startup packages and things, that you'll see that there's some inequity in some of those things. But I think that's been changing, and I think that the administration is certainly supportive of, I think they want to get rid of whatever biases there are.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about, I was asking you about the professional organizations, but we already talked about that. You did list them. Good. Now we'll even, life after work.
Okay.
Could you talk about your family? How do you balance work and your family? And then what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working?
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, the one thing that I haven't been successful in is really balancing things. And I came here as a young woman in my early 30s. And the tenure track was relatively stressful, and I guess one of the things that I regret is that I haven't found a mate to, you know, it would be nice to share my life with someone, although I've probably been on my own, you know, long enough now that I'd be pretty hard to live with. So my family consists primarily of my parents. I'm an only child. They live in California, and they're aging. And then, you know, the rest of, I have some, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles, but I'd say that my, you know, my other family is really a network of friends, some of them here, but many of them in other parts of the country, and I've managed to stay in touch in part because I like to travel, and I've had opportunities to see them. So I have, you know, very close friends in Washington, D.C., and every time I go there, I see them, and I have a close friend whose children are, you know, sort of, I'm honorary Aunt Jean, who lives in New Mexico, and I have a you know, annual visit to them, and we've taken vacations together to a number of places, and friends in California that I've known since childhood. And
do you get back to California?
I get back to California a couple of times a year. Usually my parents used to come out here at least once a year, but it's getting more difficult for them to travel, at least for my father is less willing to travel. He's 82. My mother was out here in the fall, and I, you know, one concern that I have is that if, you know, they need my assistance, the fact that they're in California makes that a bit challenging. Although, in the position of department chair with a little bit lighter teaching load, I actually have a little bit more flexibility, and so I took advantage of that last fall, for example, to go out for Thanksgiving, which I haven't normally done. And I go out at Christmas, and I'll see them a couple of times over the summer, probably. What do I do for fun? Well, I've always liked doing things outdoors, although I'm getting old and less flexible. But last summer, a college friend talked me into signing up for a 300-mile bike ride through Montana, where we would go over the Continental Divide. We had both passed 50, and we decided that to prove that we weren't really over the hill, we would ride over some really big hills. So I spent a lot of my spring last year training for this bike trip.
How did you train?
I'm riding around town of Dunn and south of there, and the hills around, you know, going out for 40, 50, 60-mile bike rides up outside of Madison. We have a wonderful network of bike paths here. So that's one of the, probably the sport that I enjoy the most now. When I was in graduate school, I used to do a lot of slow, long-distance running, but I have a lot of arthritis in my neck, and I can't do pounding sorts of things. I like to cross-country ski, but I haven't gotten
talk a little more about this 300-mile bicycle trip.
Well, it wasn't in one day. It was it was over a course of 5 days, and it was an escorted trip, so they were 120 riders, and we camped, but they had a van that carried our tents, and they cooked all the food and things. So you basically just had to, you know, have your bicycle and your water bottle, and
went 60 miles a day.
And we went 60 to 70 miles
over
a day.
Over hills and mountains.
Yes, over hills and mountains, yes. Very slowly. I have a small bike for a short person, and it doesn't go very fast, but I made it over. Actually, yeah, I walked down a couple of the hills that seemed a little too steep, and I wasn't quite sure that my bike, but I went up all of them, yes. Wow. Not necessarily without stopping, but I, you know, made it to the top, and decided I really was over the hill, because when I was in graduate school, I used to do a lot of cycling in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and I was in much better shape. But that's something that I, you know, I'm now determined to do more of that again. I like music. I used to play quite a bit of classical guitar. Now I'm sort of relegated to, you know, strumming folk guitar, but I enjoy playing and listening to music. Traveling is a passion, and
I know I interrupted you. We were talking about camping. When you talk about camping, are you talking about tent camping?
Yes.
Putting a tent up, trying to build a fire, making your food.
I used to do more sort of backpacking camping, where you you know, carry everything along. Because I haven't had an opportunity to do that for a long time. But when I camp, it's in a tent.
So where are some of your favorite places that you've camped or backpacked?
Well, in California, there's, you know, obviously lots of opportunities in the Sierra Nevada. So that's where I. And then when I was in college on the East Coast, I hiked small portions of the Appalachian Trail in various segments in the Blue Ridge and the Shenandoah and New England. In Wisconsin, most of the camping that I've done has been, you know, either with these trips with students or field trips with my classes, so state parks. Mm-hmm. But I've taken a couple of trips out to Yellowstone, camping trips, and the Badlands. And last summer, when I drove my car out to Montana with my bike, and I have some next door neighbors here who have a summer place in Wyoming. So I spent a couple of nights, you know, camped out in their yard in Wyoming, when I was in graduate school, when I was doing this work in Eastern Canada, I would drive through Canada and sort of camp along the way in places like Banff and Jasper, so national parks, kinds of places that I, you know, something new. I don't necessarily like going back to the same places. It's always more fun to see, you know, something that's new. I've traveled in summer of 2002. I spent a month in East Africa with a college friend and his wife and a friend of theirs. We had planned to go on a Earthwatch trip to excavate hominid fossils in Olduvai Gorge, which is one of the places that the Leakeys worked. But Earthwatch canceled or changed the dates of the trip, and we couldn't change our non-refundable tickets and our lives around. So we ended up just doing sort of a safari trip, but we camped in the Rift Valley and up near Lake Turkana. If you've seen the movie The Constant Gardener,
yes,
we were right near that little volcano that they fly over. So we
now, did you do that on your own, or did you have a guide?
We had a guide. We that part of the trip, my friends who had talked me into this had been to East Africa for the previous two summers, and they had met a Kenyan couple of British origin, mm-hmm. who run a little safari business. He's a pilot and has a small plane that holds two passengers, and there were four of us. So the way this worked is that two people flew up and the other two went with a caravan of Land Rovers, and we kind of met along the way, and then the two who had driven up flew back. So we all got to fly over the Rift Valley and see things from the air, and also got to travel on the ground. Mm-hmm. It was quite amazing.
And that was in Kenya?
That was in Kenya. We also went on the same trip. We went down to Tanzania and climbed a small active volcano that was erupting when we got to the summit, which was very exciting.
I'll bet.
I'm sure I'll do something like that again. And this spring break, I'm going with a group of students down to the Yucatan Peninsula to look at the hydrogeology there and some of the archaeological Mayan ruins, and the Yucatan is the location where a meteorite impacted the Earth that is pretty generally accepted now to be the cause of the dinosaur extinction. Exactly the mechanism of how the dinosaurs were killed off by the meteorite impact is still debated, but the meteorite is highly implicated in that, and we're going to see the some of the evidence of the meteorite impact as well.
Now, is that something the department plans? You planned that?
That's something that I planned in part because we have an alumnus of the department who has been involved in research down in the Yucatan. He works at the National University of Mexico, and he came through here last spring and said, you know, if you would like to take a field trip with students, I'd be happy to arrange it. And so I said, well, it's an offer that I can't refuse.
Right.
So I structured a fall semester reading seminar around papers related to the Yucatan. And then we're using a combination of departmental gift funds to provide to pay for the airfare and some of the logistics so that the students can do this for a couple of $100. We didn't want to exclude anybody on the basis of, you know, financial needs. So
that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
That's great.
And there's another department field trip at the same time that's going down to Argentina on a different topic.
Mm-hmm.
But international, looking at geology around the world is one of the things that geologists do.
Yeah. Sounds wonderful to me, except for the digging part or the, and I don't know about you're not camping. Are you camping in the Yucatan?
We're not camping in the Yucatan, mostly because our guide said that it's actually easier to stay in cheap motels just in terms of the amount of time that it takes to set up and break camp
and things like that. Well, that was my last question, Jean, but we've got a little bit of time. Would you be willing, is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't covered yet?
I feel like I've been talking nonstop for a long period of time.
Well, it's been very interesting.
I could say a little bit about my involvement in another National Research Council duty that I had was a board on radioactive waste management, and that was also a very interesting experience. I served 2 3-year terms on this board that has some review oversight responsibilities for the high-level waste repository that's planned for Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And at the start of that process, similar to the start of the Everglades process, I didn't know a whole lot of the details. I had some technical expertise that was useful, but both of those, it was a tremendous learning experience for me. Also, very vivid illustration of how much or little science can actually contribute sometimes to major policy decisions, because the science can inform the decisions, but a lot of the decisions really are value-based judgments. And that was particularly true in the case of radioactive waste disposal, that ultimately deciding how long we owe protection to people and what's an acceptable risk is not a scientific question at all. Mm-hmm. And yet science is always being asked to help adjudicate these things. And you know, many cases I find that the policymakers want scientists to sort of bless policy decisions that they've already made. And as a result of that, I learned a tremendous amount about that process. I was also able to organize a field trip for students to both Nevada and New Mexico, where one of the things that we did was get to go underground into places where they were planning, still are in the case of Yucca Mountain, and actually now are in fact doing a disposal of radioactive waste underground. And so I like to, you know, weave those kinds of professional service opportunities into, you know, both learning for myself and learning for students through opportunities for field trips. And I may try to take a field trip to the Everglades at some point as well. But
you know, I'd like to go on that one.
Yeah.
Well, the only other question that I had then was, would you talk just a little bit about your solar-powered home?
Oh, sure. This comes from my sort of long-standing commitment to the environment, and I think that geologists, as much as anyone, realize that our supplies of fossil fuel are finite, and the information, the data that we have that suggests that humans are having an important impact on climate, I think is very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been interested in alternative energy, renewable energy, energy that doesn't produce carbon dioxide for a long time. But I had gone to an energy fair, first Midwest renewable energy fair that was held back in 1990, and at that time most of the solar sorts of things were really for people living in rural areas and off the grid. In 2000, I had decided it was time to upgrade from my 67 Volkswagen Beetle to a hybrid car that were finally coming out and would get better fuel mileage and reduced CO2. So I went to the energy fair that year because I knew that the hybrid cars were going to be on display and they weren't yet in the dealerships. So I went to see the car and I saw these shingles that you can put on your roof in place of shingles that were photovoltaic and would generate electricity. So I started talking to the guy at the booth and he said, yeah, you know, you can do this in town too. You can connect to the utility grid and run your meter backwards. And I said, oh, really? I didn't know that that was legal. So there was someone from the utility there, and I went over and talked with them, and they said, yes, indeed, you can do this. And I needed a new roof. My neighbor had been telling me that my roof looked like it was falling apart on the sunny side of the house. And so the timing was right, and I sort of went away from this energy fair with this idea of, well, maybe I'll just put these solar panels on my roof, and did a little bit more exploring, discovered that no other homeowner in Madison had done this yet, but there were a couple of demonstration projects that the utility had paid for, one at the Quaker Meeting House, or the Friends Meeting House, and one on the University Arboretum Visitors Center building, and some other places. So I looked into it a little bit more and ended up contracting with the installer who was doing the Friends Meeting House, who was working for the utility. And I ended up being the first homeowner to do this, so there were some things to work out with the utility, but it was affordable to me at the time. It's not going to pay for itself in its useful lifetime, but I think I've gotten more than enough value out of the educational. I've given tours for community groups and student groups, and there's an annual tour of solar homes, and I just get a lot of pleasure out of knowing that on a sunny day like it was earlier today, my roof is generating more electricity than I use on an annual basis. Hmm. So it's my little contribution
good for you.
Reducing greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there had been an article, I think, in Wisconsin Week is where...
Yeah, there was something in Wisconsin Week, and then it was featured in the home section of the Sunday paper shortly after that. And
how many years have you had it?
It was installed in the fall of 2000. It didn't actually get up and running until late February of 2001, so just over 5 years.
And no
now.
Problems?
No problems. There were some issues with... some of the equipment originally that wasn't performing up to spec, the equipment that converts the direct current that the roof generates into alternating current, which is what comes out of your plug in the wall. And I replaced that with a different, or the installer replaced it at his cost with a different model. And since that, then there haven't been any problems at all with it.
And have other? Do you know that other people?
There are about a dozen other solar roofs now in the Madison area, including a colleague in this department, John Furnell, who runs our ion microprobe, just put up a system that's four times the capacity of mine. So he's overtaken me as the environmentalist in the department. I'm embarrassed
to say.
Yeah,
but you started it.
But I started it.
Right,
and so
right.
I'm very happy to see people following suit. And I paved the way, the agreement that we had to work out between the insurance company and the utility was sort of a blueprint for other people that are doing this now. So it's much easier for them to work through the red tape than it was for me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's it. Thank you very much,
Jean. You're welcome.
Really appreciated your time, and it was so interesting.